What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Talofa ubongia Diana and good fellow morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, why are thousands of Pacific workers fleeing the PALM scheme and seeking refuge in rural communities?
At the end of the day, I just received, let's say, 200 and 300. It's when I receive this sum of money, you know, it's like a pain in my body.
A 20% increase in new HIV infections is attracting attention in the Solomons, but a bigger worry is risky behavior.
We've seen a very, very high increase in STIs. So sexually transmitted infections, on a weekly basis, we see 50 cases of gonorrhea, 50 cases of chlamydia, and 50 cases of syphilis. That's extremely high.
And later in the show, what's next for the Flying Fijians at the Rugby Nations Championship? All that and more coming up. My name is Kristen Rita Aumanu-Leong, coming to you live from Solomon Islands, capital of Honiara. Thank you, Thomas, for sharing your time with me on ABC Radio Australia, yours in the Pacific. But first, a hidden crisis is unfolding in Australia's flagship Pacific Development Program, known as the PALM Scheme, with workers leaving their Australian employers, which some say are abusive and exploitative. Some of these workers are now undocumented, unemployed and homeless, and many are now finding refuge in rural communities around Australia. Lucy Cooper visited the town of Leeton in New South Wales and files this report.
I was left with nothing.
It was supposed to be an opportunity to save money for school and support her family in the Solomon Islands. But instead, Susan Pinu found herself in dire circumstances.
I feel, sad.
She came to Australia under the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility PALM Scheme, which aims to address labour shortages in rural and regional Australia. It's often described as a win-win, filling jobs in agriculture, meat processing and aged care, while providing income for Timorese and Pacific Islanders. But the scheme has been criticised for putting its participants in danger of exploitation. For Susan, work was inconsistent. She moved to four states in just 9 months, and her take-home pay was too low because of excessive deductions.
If someone pick fast, they're gonna get everything, but if you pick slow, you have nothing. Sometimes we're gonna left with $100, $200.
Susan left her employer, a labour hire company, and she's not alone. More than 7,000 PALM Scheme workers have disengaged in the 5 years since 2019, a decision which puts some of them in breach of their visa conditions.
We heard all kinds of stories from people who'd left the PALM Scheme, some really harrowing accounts of, abuse and exploitation.
Dr. Kaya Barry is from Griffith University. She's among researchers from three universities who've put out a new report looking at the work and living conditions of disengaged workers.
We saw several pay slips that people showed us where they'd receive zero take-home pay, zero net pay. They're largely being exposed to situations that are equivalent to modern slavery. So they have no legal status in Australia. That means they have no support for Medicare, for work cover, for any kinds of rights that everybody else, either on a temporary visa or an Australian citizen, has.
She said PALM Scheme workers arrive with visas tying them to one employer, and they face barriers to changing jobs if they encounter problems at work.
A lot of the workers that we've spoken to have felt that they were just unable to ask for changes, whether that's changes just to the role or the kind of work they're doing, or changes to their location in where they work.
One former PALM worker, Wayne Levy, left his employer, a labour hire company, over concerns about excessive deductions and low pay.
There is no transparency regarding our payment. We don't know what's going on. All the deduction, we don't know what we deducted for. At the end of the day, I just received, let's say, 200 and 300. So I can't support my family. I have kids back home, and they have to attend their education, and I have to plan, I have to meet for the future. It's when I receive this sum of money, you know, it's like a pain in my body. Yeah.
He's since gained a bridging visa, which allows him to work on a citrus farm.
See, this is a good opportunity. I come and show the citrus farm. Yeah, it's a good money here.
He ended up in the New South Wales Riverina town of Leeton.
I love Leeton. I want to stay here for the whole of my life. If I can get my family here too, it would be great, yeah.
The sun-drenched horticultural hub is home to fruit and rice-growing industries that fill supermarket shelves across Australia. It's here that community leaders have seen an influx of workers looking to make ends meet.
People aren't becoming disengaged here in Leeton. They're disengaged before they come to Leeton. So they come here seeking friendship, connections, and some opportunities to work.
Paul Matem leads the town's multicultural support group. He also served as the local mayor for 16 years.
We can't walk away when we see people that maybe haven't been treated fairly. They don't really know where to go. They're frightened. They don't have any real connection, so we fill that gap.
He was pivotal in creating the reputation Leeton has today, one of acceptance and safety.
We don't have a brick wall around our town, and we never will. There'd be a huge void if suddenly they all had to go home.
Do you get paid for the work that you do?
No.
Why do you do it?
Well, in a nutshell, I care. So I care about people, and I certainly feel that I have an obligation. And certainly when I retired from mayor, I certainly didn't retire from care.
Susan Pino didn't return home after leaving the PALM scheme. Her family needed financial support and she feared violence from someone she knew back home. She too found herself in Leeton after forming a relationship with a former PALM worker and falling pregnant. Soon after giving birth to her daughter, Angela, there was a breakdown in the relationship.
And that time, like, after everything, I feel like commit suicide. Yeah.
She found support from a Leeton family who gave her accommodation and community workers who helped her obtain a bridging visa, letting her study aged and disability care.
That's bring me, like, that's comfort, bring me, like, oh, I'm someone.
Paul Matem said many former PALM workers who are pregnant go months without medical care.
The worst case I've seen is one woman 8 months pregnant that's never been to a doctor, remembering they've got no health cover, they've got nothing there to give them any cover, so they just turn up.
Leeton Mayor George Weston is proud of the culture Leeton has, but warns everything has a tipping point.
We go out our way to try and help these people, it's not a burden. It can be a burden if it left for go too long. If more and more people come here, we need really help from the federal government, you know, to help us with these people who've been disengaged to back into working again.
Leeton Mayor George Weston ending that report from Lucy Cooper. Now we'll have more on that story on our Monday show, where we'll look at how the town of Leeton is hoping to be a model when it comes to dealing with disengaged workers.
In the Fale is a music show on ABC Radio Australia, hosted by me, Paola Tukefu. I'll be spinning my favourite tunes from dancehall to disco, calypso to country, reggae to roots, and hip-hop to house music, from across the era to keep the kids and the aunties happy. If it has a pumping groove, I'll be bringing it to you to bump you into the weekend.
In the Fale, Friday afternoons at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Kick off your Sunday with Kuntamari Crofts on Pacific Sundays, right here on ABC Radio Australia. Pacific Sundays is a laid-back weekly wrap of all things Pacific, from news, sport and entertainment to the best island music vibes. So whether you're chilling out, heading off to church or catching up with family, be entertained as you do it with Pacific Sundays. Every Sunday at 6 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Turning to Solomon Islands, where there's been an alarming increase in HIV infections, with the Health Ministry announcing 34 new cases. 5 of these are female and 29 male. It marks a 20% increase in new infections compared to last year's figures. One group worried about these new statistics is the Solomon Islands Planned Parenthood Association. Its director, Jack Martin, told me that Solomon Islands, like its Melanesian neighbours Fiji and PNG, is likely to see a surge in cases in the coming years.
With HIV, we've only seen an increase. I think it's the awareness as well on people coming forward for testing, people trusting the testing sites, both ministry and as well as private clinics such as SIPA. I think the testing is the confidentiality is what is allowing people to come. That's one. Number two is when people progress from HIV to AIDS, they will get really sick. And a lot of people presenting, they've been sick. They've had, you know, oral thrush. So in their mouth, they have a whitish kind of discharge. In their private areas, they would experience abnormal discharge continuously coming and going. They would experience a lot of diarrhea for a prolonged period, maybe. And so people are sick when they present. And because it's to do with their private areas, that's why they come to the clinic.
Of this trend, how many has been recorded here in SIPA alone? And what's the trend you're seeing? Are there worrying trend practices?
I think here at SIPA for this year, 8 of the 34 came from our clinic, as well as the contact tracing in relation to the 8. There are a number of other people. So I would say that, you know, a significant portion of those who have tested positive this year have come through our services and the contact tracing. In terms of what is worrying the trend of those tested, of course, as everybody already knows, the majority are men who have sex with men. I think the worrying part is that they have multiple partners. So the minimum would be 5, and it could go and has gone up to 8 in some instances. We also find that with men who have sex with men, a number of those who have tested are also bisexual. So they are sleeping both with men and both with women. What that means is that the sexual behavior of people, they're having multiple partners and unprotected sex. In addition to that, we've seen a very, very high increase in STIs. So sexually transmitted infections, on a weekly basis, we see 50 cases of gonorrhea, 50 cases of chlamydia, and 50 cases of syphilis. That's extremely high for any clinic. And we see that in a week in our Honiara clinic. So that means that the trend of unprotected sex and risky behavior is extremely high. I think in terms of HIV to AIDS, if we would say, you know, the transition from HIV to AIDS. So we're seeing a lot of people now in Solomon's, there's rapid progression. So what that means is, you know, before we were told by awareness and mass media that if you have HIV, it takes 8 to 15 years before you will go to AIDS. Now we're seeing people transition very quickly. So we've seen a lot of people transition within 2 years, very commonly now, that are already transitioning to AIDS. I think there's a contribution. One is that in places like Solomon's, you know, cost of living is high. So a lot of people resort to rice, noodles, you know, a lot of processed food, a lot of cheap processed food. So our diets are we don't have good health practice. And that could contribute to weaken your immune system. And then on top of that, we have very high incidence of NCDs, non-communicable disease, you know, diabetes, high blood pressure, very common now in Solomon's, even with young people. So I think the trend now, there's that big difference of how we perceived HIV 10, 15 years ago to what we see now.
And in the past, people would need to wait for laboratory results to know their status. How is that changing? How accessible are tests nowadays?
Yeah, so you can come in anytime to any clinic, whether it's government clinic or SIPA clinic, and you can get a rapid test very easily. It's just a prick on the hand, and you can get your results there. Of course, if you're positive, you will go for reconfirmation testing, but it's very easily accessible. And I think the thing I want to stress is it's confidential. That's why we see more people coming now, because they trust the system. They trust that they won't be exposed. Like this year we announced, you know, Ministry of Health announced 34 people. Nobody knows who they are. Everybody's asking on social media, name them, you know, a lot of stigma, discrimination, but I think they trust that testing is easily accessible. So yes, it's just a prick of the finger and you know your results.
As you mentioned, there are stigma and underreporting. Some are saying that it may mean that the actual scale of the numbers could be worse than what's being reported.
Certainly with any HIV increase, we've seen it the world over and regionally in countries like Fiji, Papua New Guinea. I'm sure we are now experiencing our increase. I'm certain that we will see an even bigger increase. Because what we must consider is of the 34 people tested positive, their partners, if I'm referencing myself earlier, I did say there are between 5 to 8 partners for each person through the counseling that's picked it. So of course there will be more cases, and I think we will see, sadly, we will see an increase. But that's if people trust the system enough to come in for testing.
Well, what needs to be done now?
I think one is there needs to be proper awareness that it needs to be seen. It's just a disease and infection. There's treatment available compared to 10, 15 years ago. You had to have multiple tablets daily. Now it's just a one tablet treatment. So treatment is readily available. We don't want people to go into AIDS stage. We want people to remain in HIV stage. If you're faithful on the drugs, you know, the viral load goes down. You can't pass the virus on to another person. So I think the important thing now is to go out and do a bit more testing. We need to do focused testing. So there are key populations in the community. Of course, we know men who have sex with men. We know we have sex workers in a number of our provincial centers. We know that young people out of school, especially, who enjoy time on the roadsides, drinking a lot of kwaso and smoking marijuana, we know they get into a lot of risky behavior. So we need to target our focus on how we test initially before we do mass testing. In countries like Solomon, there are limitations with budgets too, so we need to focus on where the greatest need is currently.
Just with the withdrawal of aid from United States, how has that impacted the region in the HIV space and the work that you do?
I think regionally, the withdrawal of U.S. funding has affected all the key regional and international partners in the health space, namely WHO, Global Fund, UNFPA. You know, they've experienced significant funding cut. And what that means is these institutions, they put money into our national government responses. And once that dries up, that means that even the national responses, they will dry up. We're very fortunate in the Pacific that Australia has stepped up, as well as New Zealand, but primarily led by the Australian government, really stepping up to support the responses.
Jack Martin, director of SIPA, that's the Solomon Islands Planned Parenthood Association, speaking to me there. To Papua New Guinea, where conjoined twins Tom and Sawong are this morning at Sydney Children's Hospital for urgent medical treatment. The twins, who are joined at the lower abdomen and share a single liver, were flown in from Port Moresby yesterday evening on a private medical plane. It was almost 2 months ago when the twins were born in a remote area in Morobe province and were taken to a Port Moresby hospital for treatment. But what would happen beyond that was uncertain until now. So our reporter in Port Moresby, Thekla Gunga, has been covering this story and joins us now. Thekla Ikaganba.
Ikaganba, good morning.
Good fellow morning. Well, Thekla, you've been following this story ever since the twins were brought into Port Moresby. So they'll be turning 2 months next week. What condition are they in? Mm-hmm.
I would start by saying they're incredibly strong, these two twins. They have been at the private hospital for over 3 weeks, but almost 2 months in Port Moresby. And just during the week, the start of the week, one of the twins, the weaker one, Tom, he had some swelling around his face. And because of that, it was raising like a medical emergency. The concerns were like the nursing team were really concerned that they needed to get them off to a overseas hospital quickly. And that was exactly what they did. So the twins are away, are not in Port Moresby anymore. And we are just monitoring them from Port Moresby.
Yes, Thekla, I believe you were also tracking their flight last night when they eventually left Port Moresby. But there were also talks of the twins going to Germany, but they are now in Australia. So why are they in Australia?
Yes, we couldn't wait for them to get off PNG soil. We were tracking the flights until they arrived in Australia at 8 o'clock. So the going to Australia is because Germany is all the way across the world, and just how to get to Germany, even though the team in Germany were like already on standby and waiting for them. They've released an approval letter that they will accept the twins in Germany. But it's just like logistically hard to get to Germany because there's no direct flight from Port Moresby to Germany. So they are now in Australia. There was a team of Australian doctors that came up to do like initial tests, I think 2 weeks ago. And based on that, they've accepted the twins to go to Australia. So yeah, it's such a relief that they're now in a facility that's more advanced.
Yes, and now that they're in Australia, do we know how long the twins will be there for before they are actually separated?
That's the question everyone is asking. The doctors at the Paradise Hospital told us that for surgery cases, it will require like at least 2 weeks before the actual surgery, because they needed to do like all the tests, and the important thing was blood works. So because they are like a very special case, they will give at least 2 weeks before the actual separation. So we're looking at like a month. But it can be done quickly if because of the medical condition they are in, and it's becoming risky.
And I understand like they are there now in Australia to receive the urgent medical treatment. But this is a very rare case, and we know that there were so many discussions as well on the outcome of the separations. Mm. Doctors have also said that only one twin will survive. I wonder how the parents are. How are they settling with all this happening?
Yeah, it's really challenging for the parents. I can say that they're under a lot of stress because Papua New Guinea, we haven't, you know, seen such a medically complex conjoined twins case. So the doctors in Port Moresby, right from the start, they keep telling they were talking with the parents and they were telling them that this is a really complicated case because the twins share one liver and parts of their intestines. So it means that in the event that they are separated, one twin is going to die or both of them are going to die. And that's the reality. So over time, the parents have sort of like understood and accepted because they are people from the village. So yeah, you know, medical terms to simple terms in Tokwisin, it's really it was hard for them to accept it at the first. But one thing the father said was, he said, if the twins were given to us a gift from God, and if he takes one, we are happy. If he takes both, we will still be happy. But if they survive, both of them survive like miraculously, then that would be our miracle story for the rest of our life. So they're just accepting the outcome, the two parents. And yeah, I must say they're really stressed out, but they're just hoping for the best. And we are all hoping for the best. We're just waiting for when the separation happens.
Yes, and in terms of public reaction, Thekla, how is public reacting to the news about the twins going to Australia?
Yeah, that's everyone was surprised. They're like, what? We thought they're going to Germany. But it's not really about like the which country they're going. The doctors kept saying that, look, whatever happens, wherever they go, it's best for the children. So like initially there were some setbacks that there were talks about funding and all this stuff about them not going to Australia. And I think because we broke the story, I think, just late in the afternoon. And, yeah, people are saying, like, they're questioning our story. Are they really going to Australia? Or, but, yeah, those sort of questions will be raised. But I think the bigger thing is it's the lives of the two twins. I mean, the twins we're trying to save here. I mean, not with me, but the medical team are trying to save here. So, yeah, we're just happy they're at the advanced hospital.
Yes, Thekla, and you've also been tracking this story since the twins arrived in Pome. How are you feeling about this story?
Mm-hmm. Yesterday when I saw the picture of the twins, they were in an incubator at the airport, and I just saw the cute little ear protections that they had on the twins, and it just like broke my heart. I was like, oh my goodness, these two little fighters, they're, you know, they've been alive for 2 months now. And it sort of like become emotional because I sort of felt like I'm related to them just from speaking to their parents and hearing, you know, how they're feeling and how the doctors are talking to. So, yeah, it was really emotional. But the picture that they sent to us, it was so cute. They had little protections on their ears and they had like a PNG color cap on their head. So, yeah, we're just praying for them to be okay.
Yes, and I understand you really took a lot of time to try to break down the complexities between, as you mentioned, their talk piecing from the medical terms to layman term. But has the PNG government played a part in getting these twins to Australia?
That's a really good question. In terms of PNG government, I cannot be sure, but I feel that the Port Moresby General Hospital was like the spokesperson for the government because they were doing the initial tests and, initial tests. But the PNG government, I can't remember if that was even mentioned in the parliament when they were passing the budget. But, yeah, I can't say anything. I might lie here.
Well, Thekla, we also understand now that they're in Australia. There is a huge PNG diaspora there. Finally, are there any plans for the PNG community in Sydney to perhaps visit or rally around them and provide support in Australia?
Yeah, that's that was exactly what the boss of Paradise Hospital said, Mrs. Janet Seals. She was saying that, oh, I'm calling out to all the Papua New Guineans in Sydney, like this, the parents are from the village, they will not, you know how to eat the type of food in Australia, it's a strange land, so she's asking everyone to like come together and, yeah, cook some local food and at least go visit them and speak to them in Tok Pisin because, you know, everything would be in English. But there is one person that I'd like to mention, Captain Juren Roo. He's the boss of Manolos Aviation. He was like he called himself a chainsaw. So he was the person that was behind all these things. Even though he's a pilot, he was, you know, talking using medical terms, pushing for the two twins to be to leave Papua New Guinea as soon as possible. So, yeah, I feel like he was acting like the PNG government and speaking with all the hospitals in like German and Australia and I think India. So that, when we were talking with the doctors, we asked, like, how do you find this guy, Mr. Roo? And they were saying, oh, he's such an incredible person because he was the one that sort of, like, made this an emergency, like, even though it was a medical emergency, he made it, like he was, like, just pushing for it. So, yeah, he's the person that was acting like the PNG government and speaking to hospitals overseas.
Yes, Thekla. And, you know, there were so many challenges as well, as you spoke about there earlier. But we hope that the PNG community in Sydney will also show support to the conjoined twins. But thank you, through Thekla, for story one time, you know, this last story.
Okay, no worries.
That was Thekla Gunga, the ABC's reporter in PNG. Yandra Vinaka, if you're just tuning in, I'm Kristen Rita Aumanu-Leong, live in Solomon Islands. Well, more than half a billion of funding has been approved for two massive development projects in the Pacific by the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank. $200 million will be used to build a long-awaited 720-meter bridge in Tonga that will create a second transport corridor for the capital, Nuku'alofa. A second grant of $360 million will fund the Pacific Healthy Islands Transformation Project to tackle non-communicable diseases and modernize health services in Fiji, Kiribati, Tonga, and Tuvalu. The ADB's Regional Director for the Pacific, Aaron Batten, says they are the first Pacific projects to be approved under a partnership between the two lending institutions. Here, he is speaking to Liam Fox, firstly, about the bridge project in Tonga.
ADB has been supporting the preparation of this project in Tonga since 2019, and its origins really went back to some of the resilience and disaster impacts that have affected Nuku'alofa over the years. What the project does is helps to ease urban traffic congestion by creating a secondary access route into the city, but also to promote long-term urban resilience by allowing and opening up higher bits of land on Nuku'alofa. The project also supports large improvements in drainage and flood protection for the existing road network.
And this is a grant financing, not a loan, is that right?
The project will be supported with $140 million in US dollars funding in grant, and that will be provided by the ADB, the World Bank, and by the government of Tonga itself. The funding is being mobilised under our new joint partnership with the World Bank, which means that the government of Tonga only needs to follow a single set of procedures, with the ADB acting as the lead financier. And what this does is help to streamline the bureaucracy required and allow us to deliver the funding quicker and faster to deliver impacts to the people of Tonga.
Has the land been secured for the projects? Has all that been finalised?
As part of this project, we've been supporting the government on all safeguards requirements, including community consultation, land acquisition, environmental protection, and that work will continue throughout the lifespan of the project, which we expect to take another 2 to 3 years to complete.
The Pacific Healthy Islands Transformation Project, what are the details there?
Yeah, the Pacific Healthy Islands Transformation Project is spread across four Pacific countries, so Fiji, Tonga, Tuvalu, as well as Kiribati. And that project is a transformational intervention to upgrade health systems across the Pacific Islands. The project will have a number of key outputs for the region, including revamping service delivery models across all four of those Pacific countries. This will particularly focus on non-communicable diseases, but also strengthening health systems and approaches so that all Pacific countries can upgrade their health system delivery.
Does that mean better training, better equipment, better facilities?
All of the above. The program will place a particular focus on training and skills development. Up to 10,000 health workers will be supported through the delivery of the program. Overall, the new partnership between the ADB is really a game changer in how we can go about supporting our Pacific clients who have much smaller bureaucracies and who do often struggle to meet all of the due diligence and bureaucratic requirements that can come from multilateral financing. So why we see this as particularly a positive step for the Pacific is they've been requesting us to work together to combine our resources so we can undertake transformational national investments.
If, say, that this the Tonga Bridge project, for example, was being funded under previous arrangements before this partnership, what you'd have two organisations financing it, the Tongan government would then have to deal with two separate loads of bureaucracy, paperwork, all that sort of stuff. Now they're just dealing with one.
Look, in the Pacific, ADB and the World Bank have always had a very close relationship, and we've always done our very best to harmonise how we work with our Pacific counterparts and to streamline. But yes, there was always a dual reporting requirement and some dual processing requirements when it came to our co-financing. What the new arrangements allow us to do is to select a lead financier, and then those policies and procedures of the single institution apply. So the Pacific government only has one partner to deal with, rather than two. So this will significantly reduce the workload and compliance on our Pacific governments.
That was the ADB's Regional Director for the Pacific, Aaron Batten, speaking there to the ABC's Liam Fox.
Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots reggae, dub and sizzling dancehall and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Kareni from Sorong Samurai and you're listening to Island Music.
Hi everyone, my name is Tierney from Te Tangi o Te Kara and you're listening to Island Music.
Island Music with Rick Howe, Saturday from 12 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia. Yours in the Pacific.
You're listening to Pacific Beat. I'm Kristen Rita Aumanu Leong. So far on the show, we heard about the plight of conjoined twins Tom and Sawong, who have been airlifted to Australia for treatment. There's also worries about sexual behaviour in Solomon Islands with an increase in sexually transmitted infections and a spike in HIV infections. And thousands of Pacific workers have been leaving the PALM scheme due to exploitation and claims of abuse. Some of them are seeking refuge in rural towns. But stay with us, because coming up and later in the show, it's Fight Night in Sydney with PNG kickboxers fronting up. Time for sport. The upside of the Flying Fijians being invited to join the new Rugby Nations Championship is the chance for the team to test themselves against the best. But the downside is that none of the fans in Fiji will get to see them play live. The Fiji Rugby Union accepted the invitation on the basis of playing their home games at neutral venues because their main stadium in Suva does not meet the competition's minimum standards. However, there are plans in the pipeline to do something about that. But securing the land and raising the finance will take time. So the Fijian fans will have to be patient, probably for another 5 years. But despite having to play every game outside Fiji for now, the chairman of the FRU, John Sunday, says they plan to reap maximum benefits where they can from what is a golden opportunity.
I was contingent on the overall timetable or the overall arrangements and the logistics around the overall tournament, because we're having 6 games at the same time and it must work in terms of the time zones and the distances just to ensure that we maintain high performance. So we were comfortable with that, given that a big chunk of our player pool lives up in the UK and Europe, so it fits well with them.
So tell me, the existing stadium in Suva, as I understand it, has been ruled out because it doesn't hold enough spectators and not enough of the stadium is undercover. If you could solve those problems, if you could make that stadium bigger and put more of a roof on it, does that mean that the fans in Fiji will get to see their team play at home in this championship sooner rather than later?
Yes, basically. So the conversation here in Fiji is around that. I know, how can we get a stadium with a minimum of 25,000 seating capacity, of which 10,000 is undercover? And now the sooner we can get that up, we can then start at least bring one game here. When one of the northern teams come down to Australia or New Zealand, they could slip over Fiji and play the game here. So from current conversations, it'll be around the 2030 mark when we can get all the renovations or even the construction of it up to the minimum requirements status.
So why the delay, the fans might ask? Is it simply a question of money and who pays for this?
Well, that's right. At this stage, the Fiji Rugby Union on our own doesn't have the balance sheet to build one immediately, but we are in the process of trying to acquire land, and that process will take some time, but also the capital raising and the funding discussion will need to continue. But we have the Fiji Sports Council, which is a government-owned entity that provides and manages the sporting facilities that we use, and that is something that they're currently looking at, how they could increase capacity of the stadium or build something new. That's a conversation that's happening with them at the moment. We've just been briefed from time to time. So that's really what's driving that part of the discussion.
In the meantime, when you play matches in the new championship at neutral venues, what share of the gate money will the Fiji Rugby Union get? Because this is a long-standing problem, is that Pacific teams playing, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere, get very little from the gate.
Well, that's true. The sense of competition called the Rugby Nations Championships in a way also addresses the revenue side of it, so that each team has an opportunity to maximize revenue capability from each of their home matches. So for us, having neutral venue and home games next July against the home unions of Wales, Scotland and England, just made sense for us to hold it in the UK. We are working with venue owners, and one in particular with Scotland Rugby Union, to see how best we could use some of their facilities to maximize the revenue for us so that we could then invest that back into our own facilities and our high performance pathways. So that's a conversation that's happening as we speak.
It would be very easy perhaps for people to suggest that Fiji are happy to be there, if you like, as part of the new Nations Championship. But clearly that's not the case. I mean, you are looking at ways that absolutely maximizing your involvement, not just on the field, but off it as well.
100%. 100%. That is probably the more important part, because that to us is transformational. If we can get that right, it will really position Fiji Rugby to go into the future at a much stronger basis. You know, I was just come back from France, visited the Marcoussi high performance facility, and, you know, it's just out of this world. We'd love to have one ourselves. But a couple of days later, we played France at the stadium and we were competitive all the way. And, you know, I'm thinking, wow, these guys have come out from this high performance facility. We don't have any high performance. We're still competitive. So how better would we be if we have had our own high-performance facility? So that's the focus, is just to try and maximize, at least so we can invest it back in a high-performance facility here and to where we can generate better quality players to go out into the world. That's the key. And we now need to negotiate with these bigger unions. They have much bigger market power and they have the assets and they can determine and dictate their prices. So we're saying, look, it's in the spirit of rugby and we're a small island state that's qualified. We've done the best that we can do with the very limited resources we have. You know, all we're asking for is just in the spirit of rugby, give us a helping hand. The home unions will have their chance to maximize their revenues when their home games are held in the November window. And, you know, they will make a lot of money out of that. So we're just asking, look, can we strike a deal where we'll give you some, but, you know, give us more so that it could be transformational and more meaningful for us. So that's where we're at.
John Sunday, chair of the Fiji Rugby Union, on the line there from Suva, and he was talking to Richard Ewart. And along with just about everyone else in Fiji, I can already imagine they'll no doubt be keeping a close eye on the second round of the World Rugby Sevens Series in Cape Town this weekend. The Fijian men's team will be up against New Zealand, Great Britain and South Africa in the pool round, while Fijianas will take on New Zealand, Great Britain and the USA. There'll be a feast of kickboxing tonight with three Papua New Guineans fighting title bouts in Sydney. For PNG kickboxer Mark Sondo, he'll be looking for a win to mark an end to a prodigious career. PNG kickboxing president Stanley Nandex is leading a tour to Australia, which will provide a good experience for young fighters on the team.
We have six fighters now in Sydney at the moment. We have three fighters who will be fighting in the main world title shorts, and then three just the main undercards. But yeah, I think all are ready for the fight. I think we have the likes of Mark Sondo and Kundup Samson. Also, I think Afi, you actually fought last weekend, and he'll be on the same show as well as Clinton. I think Clinton, we haven't really confirmed his fight due to last fight, and he may have the injury, but we can't force him. If he's got an injury, we may just just put him off. But what we have at the moment is Norman Kawake is our current eight-man champion, and also the recent September 13th, the rest of the world as PNG international title holder as well, and we just brought him in. We're looking at a good surprise from him on Friday night.
How has the preparations been so far since the September fight in Port Moresby?
Yeah, I think the preparation has been good. We've been after the event. We didn't stop straight after the event. Some of the fighters were sent down to Australia in terms of the preparation towards this fight, and some of that we kept up there, and then the training has been really good. So I think these guys are really much looking forward to take on the current world champions. You know, it won't be that easy, and so these guys know the business, and I think they're here for the fight, so we are looking forward to it.
You had some setbacks in terms of visa issues and perhaps financial constraints, but you're looking forward to taking home some titles?
Yes. Unfortunately, Nelson Sampson, who was supposed to also be on the card, unfortunately didn't make it through with the visa issues. And also we have a female fighter, also his opponent got withdrawn to Kombukon, and that was a bit of a setback. And also with the sponsors, in fact, finally we just got some support from, you know, PNG Sports Foundation and National Youth Development Authority. They have just come on board quickly to support us because they knew this was the very important event for the end of the year. end of the program for this season. And I think that was what they have also seen, that how important it was. So we were supported very much timely. And I think our business now is just to really stay focused and prepare ourselves. Most of the fighters have been already, especially the opponents, they accessing through their video profiles and trying to just look at the strategies, how they can get in. But I think in terms of physicality, the preparation, the mindsets and everything, I mean, this guy's been well prepared. So we are looking forward.
And 2025 has been a good year for boxing, Kickboxing Federation of Papua New Guinea. You've had few fights in Australia. The same fighters are coming back. Some of them won titles. Some of them are here to reclaim their titles or fight for their titles. What outcome are you expecting from this fight?
Yeah, towards the lead up, I think we've been doing really well. Also, with the recent event on the 13th of September as part of our celebration up there, the 58th, it's been really good. I think 96-97%, we've been really good with our ratings. And I think this is going to be another event that is going to be quite tough than what we had in Moresby, because fighting the current world titles holders is going to be a lot hard for us. But I think with the build up towards this event has been really good for us, and we've been staying much focused into it. So our boys are good. They are very committed. They're disciplined. And I think they're here for the business. So we are looking forward.
This is your final fight for the season, as you've mentioned. Any other coming events next year? Hopefully you're looking forward to bringing more fighters into Australia.
Yes, of course. I think after the September 13th event, it was one of those highlights that actually, because it was also televised worldwide. And that's why now we seem to be getting a lot of invitations and also signing in to do all different promoters and different organizations. And I think they've been inviting most of the fighters. So this year, it's going to be the last event for this December. I think we just got also a few calls. There's an event on the 13th of December this year as well. That will be the last event for this year. So we'd like to also end that up. It's really depending on the fighters. If they don't have an injury for this event, then hopefully we might also put them on the show on the 13th, just before we depart the country on the 15th of December as well.
And that was PNG Kickboxing President Stanley Nandex talking to reporter Godwin Eki. Meanwhile, Nandex is calling on Papua New Guineans living in Sydney to come along and support the team. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look at our main stories today. PNG conjoined twins Tom and Sawong are in Australia for medical treatment at a Sydney hospital. There's also been a spike in HIV infections in Solomon Islands, with worries about risky sexual behaviour. There's been an exodus of Pacific workers from the Palm Scheme, with rural towns providing refuge for disengaged workers who have breached their visa conditions. You can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time with Agnes Tupou. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia. Up next is News and Nisia Daily. I'm Kristen Rita Aumanu Leong, coming to you live from Solomon Islands. Thank you too much for time, Blue.